We now turn to a story about what can happen when chance meets journalistic perseverance. In late 2001, Alan Cullison was in Afghanistan covering the Northern Alliance for the Wall Street Journal. A car accident left the journalist intact, but his laptop computer destroyed. After the fall of Kabul, Cullison set out to find a new computer to assist him filing his stories. What he ended up with proved a lot more valuable. Two computers, which reportedly had belonged to Osama bin Laden's military commander, Mohammed Atef, and to his right-hand man, Alman Zawahiri. What Cullison found on those computers became a series of stories in the Wall Street Journal in 2002. It's now the subject of a cover story in September's issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Alan Cullison joins us now from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
The story of how you found these computers is fascinating, as it started with some bad brakes on the road to Kabul.
Yeah, basically I got into the wrong truck. I had been sent into northern Afghanistan to cover the American bombing campaign against the Taliban, and when I was crossing the Hindu Kush, the brakes gave out on the truck, and we went down a mountainside and rolled, and That smashed the computer. Fortunately, nobody was hurt.
So what happened when you got to Kabul? You don't go down to the computer district like you would in New York City.
No, there aren't. There were not many computers in Afghanistan at the time, and I'd been sent a replacement laptop, which didn't work very well, and I was looking around for some software, and so I sort of got acquainted with the few computer dealers who did exist. And in the course of talking to one of them, he said, well, there might be a possibility of getting some looted Al-Qaeda computers, and so we went on a search.
You were then stopped looking so much for a replacement, but for a story.
No, we were looking for the goods. There was a bit of competition at that time in Kabul because it had fallen so quickly and unexpectedly. A lot of journalists were going into Al-Qaeda houses looking for documents, and I was frankly a little bit behind on the story, and so this was a way of catching up.
And what you found was a man who had, liberated these computers from the Al-Qaeda offices the night they fled.
Yeah, he was a profiteer in the purest sense. He was a jewelry salesman, and he said that the night that, the Taliban were fleeing Kabul, he climbed over the wall of this Al-Qaeda house and went in and got these two computers and climbed back over the wall with them.
Now, how soon did you recognize what you had here?
Well, opening up the desktop computer, the IBM, it wasn't really easy to tell what was there. First of all, it was protected by a password, which had to be bypassed. But we did all this in Kabul. There were a lot of files in Arabic, and most of them were locked with passwords or encrypted. But one of them we opened, which was in French, was a letter to Ahmed Shah Massoud, the head of the Northern Alliance, and this was a letter of introduction for the man who eventually killed him with a suicide bomb. So it was clear that this was an Al-Qaeda computer after reading that letter.
Your editors, once they found this out, decided to call the CIA.
Yes, that was a particularly unusual time in the United States at the time. There were anthrax attacks, and everyone was expecting something else to happen, and so the concern was that the computers would hold some information about future attacks, as indeed the IBM computer did.
The future attack in question was information about the man who would become later known as the shoe bomber.
Yes, Richard Reed. This computer did link Richard Reed to Al-Qaeda. It contained a report by Reed, basically a casing report, where he spotted targets in Israel and Egypt and traveled under the alias of Abdul Rauf. I imagine it's a casing report similar, I would guess, to what they're uncovering now in this recent discovery of a computer.
Very little, though, on yours in English. But I gather you had a chance to copy what was on the laptop computer. Eventually, the CIA took the computers away from you, and you describe a scene in which they're returned, which involves a covert curbside connection with an agent named Bert. Tell us about that.
Well, it was actually a colleague who went and got the computer from Bert. The fact was that there were two computers, and I was able to copy one. we got the laptop. I was able to copy the desktop computer, but the laptop we did not copy, and we got it back from Bert at a curbside in Washington, D.C. later. They told us that that computer had been empty.
And you say you've always wondered about that.
Yes, there are reasons to wonder. But,
now, let's go into what you did find, though, on the computer, the copy that you did have, which are, in addition to the security information, there's a lot of correspondence leading up to and after 9/11, which is fascinating. But there's also some stuff about the daily life within al-Qaeda that, I just never read before.
Well, that is perhaps maybe the most interesting thing about going through this computer. It was what a intelligence analyst would probably call a multiple-use computer. It wasn't anybody's computer specifically. A lot of the leadership of al-Qaeda used it. And, unlike a personal computer, for instance, that, one of these guys might have had, there weren't any nudie pictures or pornography or anything like that. It was all, it was for the most part, very wholesome Islamist literature and dialogue between offices and, also baby pictures of, their families and personal letters.
And office sniping, you're not keeping good accounts. What's up with you?
Yeah, in contrast to the popular image of al-Qaeda as being, a very well-funded organization, these guys were often fighting over some pretty scarce resources, and the pettiness descended to something, I would imagine a little bit like the atmosphere at an alternative newspaper in college or something. It got very unpleasant and personal.
And we had often heard that there was some tension between the members of the Taliban were a bit resentful of some of the Arabs, as they called them. They were from a lot of different places, but they called them generally Arabs in al-Qaeda. This, as you learned, cut both ways.
Yeah, specifically the Arabs, really, a lot of the people in the Islamists wondered whether Afghanistan was really a good place to be heading up their jihadi cause. It was, of course, safe because the government was not against them, but they looked down on the Afghans as some unlettered and not people that they could trust, and likewise that the Taliban were jealous of the Arab resources. Although everyone was the Arabs did complain about conditions there. The Taliban seemed to think that the Arabs were living in luxury.
There were a lot of communications between senior members of the al-Qaeda leadership and various correspondents in various parts of the world. Interesting how they conducted those communications, and also a code language that they developed, very much like copied off global business.
Yeah, they essentially mimicked the language of a multinational corporation. There was Bin Laden was the contractor, and the foreign intelligence services like the MI5 or MI6, the CIA, were foreign competitors, or the Egyptian Security Service, foreign competitors. They speaked about, they spoke about projects sort of in the terms of, raising gardens or farms and, about...
My favorite was the yogurt project for chemical and biological weapons.
Yes, the yogurt project was actually a rather important one to them in 1998, 1999, but even though it was a large and important project to them, I believe the startup project, I forget the exact sum, it was about $2,000 startup sum for it. It was pretty low budget, never really got very far. They hired an expert by the name of Abu Kabab to help them, but as far as we could tell, they only got as far as nerve gas and gas some dogs over in one part of Afghanistan.
Just let me read one of these letters. This is to Ayman al-Zawahiri from unknown incoming mail from Yemen, May 13th, 1999. Dear brother Salah al-Din, 40 of the contractors, bin Laden's friends, were taken by surprise by malaria, arrested a few days ago, following the telegram they sent, which was similar to Salah al-Din's telegrams. That is, they use the same code. The majority of them are from here, Yemen, and two are from the contractor's country, Saudi Arabia. We heard that al-Azmar had a sudden illness and went to the hospital. Prison, it goes on like that.
Yes. Well, if somebody came down with malaria in one of these memos, it usually meant he was arrested. If he was in the hospital, that meant he was in prison, and waiting to see the doctors, that meant he was waiting for the lawyers. It was a pretty elaborate, but essentially transparent after a while system of code that they used.
We're speaking with Alan Cullison of the Wall Street Journal, the author of a cover story in the September Atlantic Monthly, Inside Al-Qaeda's Hard Drive. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And there's a question from a listener. Lewis is on the line with us from Silver Spring, Maryland.
Hi. I don't doubt the veracity of your guest, but I wonder that an organization as sophisticated as Al-Qaeda would leave computers available to be taken without them being some surreptitious reason in their minds for you to get them. Are you sure that this was the real stuff? I mean, these little letters about being caught with malaria, they're nice things, but was there authentication? Did the big experts who know the language, etc., really believe this wasn't thrown out for you to be inveigled? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Lewis. Sure.
Are we on the air? Or
yeah,
off the air?
No, you're on the air.
No, if this was a hoax, it would have to be a pretty elaborate one. There were nearly 1,000 text documents, memos back and forth, and these memos did correspond to real events. I mean, there was a talk of Zawahiri being arrested in Dagestan in southern Russia in 97, and we checked that out and found his arrest records. I think that probably the biggest misconception about Al-Qaeda nowadays really is that it is such an elaborate operation that they couldn't do something like this, leave a computer behind. There were a lot of screw-ups along the way and a lot of budget problems, a lot of infighting that nobody really wants or is inclined to believe, because they were able to pull off an attack like September 11th. People have elevated them in their minds as really an awesome group, when in fact they were, you know, susceptible to the same petty problems and inefficiencies as sort of a lot of beginners in a lot of ways.
One of the things I found most interesting was their assessment of what would happen in the aftermath of 9/11. They certainly did expect retribution from the United States, but they expected the United States, you say, to be a clumsy opponent.
Yes, they looked back on the Afghan war against the Soviet Union as sort of their heyday. It was a time when the Arab world was unified in a fight against a large oppressor, and Afghanistan was a fighting ground which where they eventually proved victorious. They were looking forward to an experience somewhat like that, I believe. Although it's hard to say whether they were expecting the war to be quite as quick as it ended up being. They were apparently surprised by the accuracy of the American bombardment and the quick fall of the Taliban. They had looked forward to a war that would basically polarize the Arab world and help them raise recruits and spread the popularity of their cause.
They had studied a lot of the classics of guerrilla warfare, including a book by later Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, but knew that this was not a strike that was going to bring down the United States or the West, but they hoped to, as you say, and get them involved in a long war that would lend support to their movement, make Al-Qaeda, a small group, suddenly take on the aspect of a mass movement, something you say certainly did not happen in Afghanistan.
No, it didn't happen in Afghanistan. I did suggest that possibly it has happened in Iraq. They were a group to some extent, as you read their correspondence. They weren't a group that pulled off terror acts because they had money. It looked more like a dynamic, like they pulled off terror acts because they needed money, and it was sort of a fundraising mechanism. And this was the largest mechanism of all, the largest publicity of them all. And there were letters before September 11th where they were talking about a large project that would generate publicity and recruits for their side.
Alan Cullison, thanks very much. Fascinating article. Alan Cullison is now a Moscow correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, author of the story Inside Al-Qaeda's Hard Drive, which is published in the September issue of the Atlantic Monthly magazine, and he joined us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.